Once upon a time, in the middle of a deep, dark factory, an average Joe,
Joe Banks,
lived a very boring life.
Good morning, Dee Dee.
Hi, Joe. What's with the shoe?
Losing my soul.
Yeah.
Until one day, he found out his life was over.
I'm not sick except for this terminal disease.
That's right. You have some time left, Mr. Banks. Live it well.
And that's...
Joe Banks?
...when his adventure began.
You and I might be able to help each other. I want to hire you to jump into a volcano.
Total red carpet situation. It's wine, women, and song in the sweetest little paradise you ever saw.
A real journey.
Are you Joe Banks?
Yeah.
Que você pensa?
Warner Brothers presents Tom Hanks, Meg Ryan,
Joe Banks.
In the story of a man, a mountain, and a miracle.
Take me to the volcano!
He's diving! He's jumping! He's leaping!
Written and directed by John Patrick Shanley, the Academy Award-winning writer of Moonstruck.
I love you.
I love you, too. I've never been in love with anybody before, either. It's great. I am glad. But the timing stinks. I gotta go.
Joe versus the Volcano.
I first saw Joe versus the Volcano in the theater in 1990 when it came out, March 9th of 1990. I remember going to the mall that was adjacent to the Joe Kubert School because that's where I was at the time. And I didn't have a lot of expectations for this movie. I like Tom Hanks and, you know, whatever. I was like, fine. Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan were not a thing in 1990. That was not like a thing in the movies at that point. So I don't remember going into it with any particular expectations. And I think probably 10 to 15 minutes into the movie, I completely fell in love with it. And I stayed in love with it. And I have never not been in love with this movie. And even during the times when it was considered a bad movie and... it became kind of shorthand for, you know, a bomb or whatever, not a good movie. I loved it. I've always loved it. And now I'm really happy to know that it's kind of made its way back again, and it's become, according to Wikipedia, a cult film.
Wow.
Yes. I'm really excited because people are now, have rediscovered that this movie is awesome. I love Joe versus the Volcano, and I was very happy to find out that you, Shag, love it as much as I do. So what's your history with this?
Well, first off, I'm just curious. When you went to go see it across the street from the Joe Kubert School,
yes,
were you under the misconception going in that it was about Joe Kubert versus an actual volcano? Or
That would be an awesome movie. I have no doubt that Joe Kubert did fight a volcano at some point in his life. But no, I wasn't under misconceptions. It was funny. I will say one other thing. As silly as it is to suggest that there were any guys at the Kubert School that were quote-unquote macho, because that wasn't a thing, there was definitely the crowd that was more of like the action guys, and they wouldn't be caught dead seeing a movie that looked like a little gentle fantasy. I was not one of those guys. I was like, I don't care. I'll see it. So, this movie just really hit me right in the feels, and it's just been there ever since.
I don't remember exactly what led me to the theater, other than I was going with my girlfriend. I remember that much. I was dating a girl for a couple of years there, and I was if it was March 1990, I was finishing up high school, and she and I would go to the movies all the time because that's what you do in high school. You know, in 1989 was an amazing year for movies. I was in the theater every Friday in 89, but so by this point we were on a date. We went to go see the film, and I don't know the exact moment I fell in love, but I know the moment when it became one of my favorite movies of all time is the luggage salesman scene. That's
right.
That's when I decided this is like my favorite thing I've ever seen. And it's always remained in the back of my mind. I've seen it probably only maybe four times at most. Once was again for this podcast, but it's just always been in my heart. It is such a fun story. It's an absolute, it's bizarre. As we talk through this, I mean, some of the weirder stuff's going to come out, but it's just joyful. I mean, that's probably the best way to put it. I just enjoy watching it, from the way it's shot to the acting to the bonkers story to the line delivery, which I guess is the same as acting, I suppose. But it's just a great film and an absolute joy.
Yeah, well, I mean, in terms of the line deliveries, I mean, that's also part of the duty of the director. And we should mention that the director is John Patrick Shanley, who's also the writer. This was his first film as a director. He had previously written Moonstruck, which was a big Oscar winner. So he kind of had a lot of heat on him at the time. And he turned to make this very strange, you know, fanciful movie. It opens up with an overture, which I really like. That's kind of an old-timey touch. As the Warner Brothers logo comes up, you hear this music coming in. And then it says, Once Upon a Time. Which,
right.
You know, plants you right in the you know, the world of like, okay, this is a fantasy, this is not exactly the real world. And yet, you know, the opening scenes are of Tom Hanks, Joe Banks, heading to his job, which is decorated, I saw this online, someone described it as the office is decorated like you'd see something from the Saw movies. And I think that's pretty accurate because he works at this horrible factory where everyone is in gray. I mean, it looks like it's something out of 1984, and it's done to the tune of 16 tons, and everybody just drags themselves into this massive structure. There's a very unhelpful sign talking about that they're very proud. It's a proud home of the rectal probe. That's a big thing that they're really excited about.
And, but how fitting is that, though? I mean, for a job that's just – I don't know what the language is on the show. Forgive me, but you're taking out the ass at this job.
Yeah.
And that's the perfect product to sell.
Yeah, yeah. The only little hope that we even have is that little dandelion that's growing out of the ground that Joe Banks takes the effort to care for. Everyone else just trudges along. And of course, the walkway to this giant factory is this very peculiar – sort of lightning bolt shape, zigzag, which, of course, will be a recurring motif throughout the movie.
It's also the company logo.
It's also the company logo.
You see that symbol within the first 2 minutes of the film. And it's also fair to say, during all these shots, all the color is sort of blanched out of the shot. It's like a Zack Snyder film. It's so drained of color, and everything's gray. When he gets in the office, everything's fluorescent. It's just gross, and it's very purposeful. You know. By the way, speaking of Zack Snyder, I do think it is time this movie be rechristened. Because, you know, you mentioned it earlier. This is before Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan were a thing.
Right.
This is before Sleepless in Seattle. This is before You've Got Mail. This is their first one. So, I hereby dub this movie going forward, Joe V. Volcano, Dawn of Shipping. So, there. It's done, folks. Warner Brothers, you're welcome.
Don't give them any ideas, please. They own the property. Don't. I don't need a gritty reboot of Joe versus Volcano. He gets into the office, and we are introduced to his boss, Dan Hedaya, Mr. Waturi, who is having one of the great all-time conversations in all the films, which consists of basically two lines. I know he can get the job, but can he do the job? There's that. And the other line is, I didn't say that. If I said that, I would have been wrong. And he simply says those two lines for, I think, approximately 3 solid minutes. And it is one of the great all-time phone conversations in all of movies. You're just like, why are you having – like, what is the matter with this man that he can't realize he's not saying something different?
No, there's nothing wrong with him. That is a realistic depiction of what it's like to work in one of these soul-sucking offices. It's an exaggeration, but dude, that's what it feels like when you're stuck listening to a boss that you hate on the phone. Oh, it's so well done.
And it's sadly true. You and I both can speak to that.
We've had many a conversation off the air about, and now, thankfully neither one of us, the jobs we're in now, but jobs we've been in previously, job that I'm not in, where my soul was literally, like, would stick a turkey baster in my heart and suck my soul out every day.
Yeah. Now, Liu didn't have a little cute Meg Ryan there, at least, to take your mind off, and she plays the secretary, Dee Dee. Who is, I love the wig that she's in and that kind of squeaky 30s voice that she's got. And the way she's sitting at her desk, she just looks like she's about to be eaten by her typewriter.
Yeah.
Which I love that body language. She's just.
And the way Meg plays it is, and I'm sorry if I'm interrupting the synopsis.
No. We're just going, bopping all around.
Okay. The way she plays the character is, you know, she's very sniffy. She's always like wiping her nose on her hand, on the back of her hand. She's got really big eyes. It's very sweet, very nervous. She's, you know, kind of simple, no makeup. And she's got this genuine smile that she gives when Dee Dee's happy, where her eyes squint up and she just kind of tilts her head a little bit. And it's adorable. It's completely different than the other characters in the film, but it's in her own way. Dee Dee is so sweet.
Yeah.
And by the way, I did meet my wife at that soul-sucking job, so I guess I kind of did have a Dee Dee. But
there you go. It's worked out in the end there. Yeah, Dee Dee, yeah, she's terrific. And I mean, Meg, you know, it's funny. Meg Ryan, we should probably get to this later, but like, you know, Meg Ryan kind of like, her career didn't quite take off the way it was supposed to. She burned brightly very briefly, but she, when she was good, she was really good. And she's terrific in this movie, and she's terrific in all three roles. And we'll get to the other two roles here, but she's really funny as Dee Dee because she clearly likes Joe. Joe likes her, but she's never going to bring herself to say anything, and he can't bring himself to say anything because he's a hypochondriac. As we find out, he's constantly sick. And, you know, his job, he works in this windowless room where he's in charge of, as Mr. Waturi puts it, the entire office library, as he puts it. And he's even got a storm drain in his office that he's not, with a giant sign that says "Do not touch." And he's sick. He's constantly sick. Joe has always got something wrong with him, and the only thing that gives him hope is his little hula lamp that he has on his desk, which is a really wonderful prop. One of the great movie props. It's the little hula dancer, and the lampshade is like an ocean front, and it twirls around and it plays a little happy song. And of course, Mr. Waturi hates it, and he demands that Joe get rid of it. But it's the only thing that I think keeps Joe sane at the moment. So that's the whole opening sequence. It's just this nightmarish thing, and it lasts about 20 minutes. That whole opening sequence is pretty remarkable.
I didn't time it. It certainly felt that long, but I didn't know. Now, I will note that, first of all, by the way, when you Google Joe versus the Volcano, one of the Google auto suggestions is Joe versus the Volcano lamp.
Right. Yeah, I actually tried to find the lamp.
Oh, no way. Really?
Yeah, it's not a prop you can buy. It was custom made for the movie. And there are people who make Joe versus the Volcano lamps. They will make one for you. Now, I was beyond sort of what I was willing to spend, but you can get them made. Yeah, everyone loved that lamp prop.
That's great.
So
it feels like 20 minutes. And part of it is one of the things I noticed the director does is he doesn't mind long shots.
Right.
You know, in an era where at least we're used to now very quick cuts, you know, and even in the 90s, by then they were already doing a lot of quick cuts. You know, there's a lot of long shots in the beginning, and it helps to add to that suffering, smothering feeling. And it's really well done.
Yeah, I have to figure that's got to be John Patrick Shanley's history as a playwright, and that he's used to not, you know, he doesn't have camera moves to rely on.
Mm.
So as a director, he's going to do a lot of he's going to stage things in a similar way as if you were sitting in a proscenium watching a play. You're seeing the whole shot all the time, and you're choosing what to look at. So I'm guessing that he's sort of giving you the same view. Because, yeah, there's a lot of things, a lot of long shots of Hanks wandering. And Hanks has this awful mullet kind of thing going on. He looks terrible. He just looks absolutely terrible. So anyway, Joe finally decides, he goes to visit, he had yet another doctor's appointment. He visits his doctor, who's just played by Robert Stack, Dr. Ellison. And it's very interesting that it's at this point where Dr. Ellison, who was originally, they originally asked Ronald Reagan to play the part of Dr. Ellison.
What?
And yeah, they did. They tried to get Ronald Reagan, and Ronald Reagan was, at the time, it was not known that he was suffering from Alzheimer's, and so it was basically they let the producers, the Reagan's, you know, reps let him know that he wasn't interested, and they find out that because he just health wise couldn't do it. But they tried to get Ronald Reagan, they got Robert Stack, and it's very interesting that the first set of warm colors we get in this movie are in Dr. Ellison's office because he's got a nice lamp and he's got a roaring fire, and it's that moment where we find out that Joe Banks has a brain cloud and is going to die in 6 months.
Poor Joe.
Yeah. So I love that dichotomy, that at the moment we're getting the worst possible news is when, you know, it is in a very nice scene and everything looks really nice and the office is you know, very warm and everything, literally and figuratively. So yeah, Dr. Ellison tells Joe that Joe is going to die. He has a brain cloud, and it's a symptomless disease. His brain will simply shut down in about 6 months. But until then, he's going to feel like he's in perfect health. And of course, Joe is like, that doesn't make any sense because I'm always sick. And that's when Dr. Ellison reveals to Joe that you're a hypochondriac. And it's the only reason that you demanded so many tests that we found this in the first place. So Dr. Ellison basically says, just go off and go enjoy yourself. Go enjoy your last couple of months in life. And the scene right at, yes?
I was going to say, Robert Stack, he only has a few lines, But just the way he presents himself and the lighting on him specifically in that scene, he's powerful. It's like one of the things I had read in a review leading up to this, and I totally agree, is regardless of how bonkers the plot is for this movie, every single person gave 100%, and you believe them, regardless how ridiculous or a caricature, even his boss, how much of a caricature that character is, that actor is playing, you believe them. They are totally in it. And even his small part, I fell in love with him in that little scene.
Right. Yeah, they got real ringers for these small parts. We'll get into some of the other actors in this movie. But yeah, everybody here really brings it. And yeah, it is kind of amazing that, we have to take the idea of a brain cloud seriously. I mean, it's a comedy, but yeah, there's something called a brain cloud, and you're supposed to not laugh. And it's right after this moment. Actually, Joe goes back to his office. And hold on, I'm jumping around. The scene immediately after the office, his doctor's office. This is an extraordinary shot. And I remember this in the theater, this moment where Joe goes out of the office and they start playing Old Man River by Ray Charles. And Joe comes out the door and John Patrick Shanley starts pulling the camera back further and further and further till Joe gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And at one point, an old woman walks by with a big dog. Mm-hmm. And Joe sees the dog, and you see them talking, you don't hear them because the music's playing, and he puts his hand on the dog's face to let him sniff it, and the dog is friendly, and then he kind of like lunges over and hugs the dog.
Yep.
And I remember seeing that in the theater, and people started to laugh, like really loudly, and I didn't laugh because I'm like, I don't think that's meant to be funny. I think it's meant to be touching. Like, he's so desperate for a connection that he's hugging this dog, and I don't think it's meant to be a laugh line. I didn't think it was meant to be funny. I thought it was meant to be sad and touching, and I thought it was sad and touching, and that's when I really thought this movie was talking to me, and then, like, and that other people were missing it a little, because I was like, I don't think that's what they're trying to do here. And I think I watched the scene again tonight, and I'm still very touched by it, because he's so sad, and he has this horrible weight of this news that he can't share with anybody. And so he just makes a connection with the first person he sees, which is the dog and the old woman. And I think it's really beautiful. And they let the whole song play out. It's a really – you mentioned long scenes. This is a long scene. I mean, this goes on for, again, probably 2-3 minutes. And it's really beautiful. I think it's what makes this movie more than just a goofy comedy. This thing has a lot more on its mind than you would expect for a movie called Joe versus the Volcano.
Right, Joe v. Volcano.
Joe V, yeah.
But,
we're not doing that again.
Now, I had interpreted a little bit more like, rather than he needed to make a connection, he was grasping for life. Like, the dog represented life to him, and he was just loving on this dog and feeling an emotion. But either interpretation works.
Yeah. Either one.
And you're right. I think probably the people who laughed at the beginning of that scene, because I mean, you came right out of a really bizarre, quirky scene with Robert Stack, which is kind of – it's sad but funny at the same time. It's designed to be, because Tom Hanks' even dialogue is funny, even though it's about death. And so you're almost like expecting something to be funny. And I think by the end of this scene, those people probably realized it was powerful because they just held on that scene forever. Yeah. Even if Joe's out of the frame and they're still holding there.
Yep.
And that you see a car drive by and you're just staring at this really beautiful, an ornate brick wall. And it's a beautiful scene. It's very, very. It was in my notes too, so I'm glad you mentioned it.
Yeah, I love it's maybe not my favorite scene, but I love it. And so he goes back to his job, and it's in that moment he quits. He tells Mr. Vittori that he's quitting, and he decides to finally let loose. And he tells Mr. Vittori everything he's been pent up all these years, and he unloosens the drain, which he's been told not to do, and nothing happens. he there's this wonderful, great bit where he's about to walk out the door, and Mr. Vittori says, you'll be easy to replace, Joe. And Joe Banks goes, I should say something. And he says it to himself really quietly, I should say something. And that's the moment that he lets rip. And who doesn't want to do that to their boss at some point, to tell their boss exactly what they think of them?
He quit extremely spectacularly. It was wonderful with with the prosthetic hand slapping his boss with it and everything. And it's so. And then I love he leaves. He storms out, comes right back in. He goes, Dee Dee, you want to have dinner? She's like, sure. He's like, all right, tonight. Yeah. Bye.
He walks right out. Yeah.
It's just I don't know, like, well, and you talked about it made a connection for you. When he stood there at the door and was taking the beating and said, I should say something, that made a connection with me.
Yeah.
That made me feel like, oh, gosh, that's me. That's my life when I'm, you know, in a bad work situation. And not the going crazy part, but just the sitting there knowing you should say something.
I love that when he complains about the coffee and he's like, the coffee, it stinks. And they cut to the other employee who has yet to ever say a word. And he just sort of nods.
Yeah.
Kind of like, you know, like he's so beaten down. He doesn't even have the ability to talk anymore. But he knows that he hates the coffee, too. I love that moment. This is great. And and Joe can't get over the fact that he gave 4 years of his life to this guy for, as he puts it, $300 a week.
Right.
You know, and again, who can't relate to that? And he packs up all the stuff, including a Classics Illustrated comic book.
I know!
Of Robinson Crusoe, which is great. I had that comic at one point. I remember that. That was really exciting to see that. And he ends up giving the lamp to Dee Dee, which is a nice gesture.
Yep.
And so, yeah, they go out, and him and Dee Dee go out, and they have a great evening. Dee Dee is really turned on by Joe because he's full of life now. He's wondering about all the questions of life.
I got to mention, this is, again, from a directing point of view. He did something really interesting here, and if you're not paying attention, you don't catch it. He used a zillion colors in the date, in the walking around, everything. Because if you go back and watch those scenes in the restaurant, there are colored – I don't remember whether they're fabrics or lanterns or something, but there is multicolored things everywhere. It's to sort of offset the, you know, the dark, gloomy part of the first movie. Now Joe has literally been freed. Now that he knows he's going to die, he's actually freer. Like you said, he's full of life. And when they go to, I guess it's his apartment building or hers, I can't remember. Every window is like a different color. There's a blue window, a red window, a green window, a yellow, you know, whatever. It's all insanely in Technicolor. It's beautiful.
Yeah, it is. It's wonderful. And they said they have a really cute date. She's really turned on. They go back to her house. They start to kind of, you know, presumably they're going to sleep together. And then he reveals that he's dying at 6 months. And unfortunately, that freaks Dee Dee out. She can't handle it. And, you know, on some level, I guess I could appreciate that. I was reading some later reviews and people were saying, you know, is it kind of cruel of Dee Dee for her to leave him like that? But at the same time, she might not want to fall for somebody who she knows she's going to die in 6 months. That seems kind of cruel too. So I never took it as a terrible thing. She just couldn't handle it. That was a big leap for her because she's still working at that job. She's still this mousy thing, and she's Joe Banks is trying to lead her kind of out of that life. But I don't know. I didn't take it as a bad mark on the character that she couldn't handle. That's a pretty heavy thing to hear from somebody.
I totally bought into it. I mean, you judging her bad or not or good or I don't think that even enters into the equation. It's just believable.
Yeah.
There are times in your life when you get into, you find yourself in a situation where you're just like, I did not know I was getting into this, and that's what she found herself in, and she couldn't cope.
Yeah. So the next morning, Joe is in his house.
Oh, by the way, that is the first kiss of Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks in a long-studded career of them kissing.
Yeah,
so.
That's right. That's right. Yes. So the next morning, Joe is just sitting playing his ukulele when he gets a visit from probably my favorite character in the movie, which is Grainamore, played by Lloyd Bridges, the great Lloyd Bridges, who is swinging for the fences.
Yes,
in this
he
scene.
Is.
First of all, he's dressed like the Riddler, kind of. He's got that old-timey kind of hat. He looks like Frank Gorshin in the Riddler, except he's not green. And he's a a billionaire industrialist. And he is on the search for an element called – what's it called, Jack?
Oh, gosh. I don't even remember. I saw it the other night. It's
Boomero.
Okay. I was going to say it's not unobtainium, is it?
No, yeah. Unobtainium, yeah. Boomero. And he tells Joe that he can only make his superconductors with this Boomero. And Boomero is only on this one small island way out in the Pacific. And the only hitch in getting the Boomero – from the people who live on the island is they have a volcano that needs a sacrifice, and it has to be a sacrifice of their own of your own volition. They can't throw somebody in there. So he has found out through Dr. Ellison that Joe is dying, and so he makes Joe an offer he can't refuse, which is basically, look, you're going to die anyway, so why don't you throw yourself into the volcano? In the meantime, I will treat you to an incredibly lavish lifestyle, an amazing trip, and you'll live it up for the last 5 months. And he gives Joe the real hard sell. There's the great moment where he walks in, he has like a walking stick, and he starts insulting Joe's house, and he literally just smashes a hole in the wall.
Just not crush. Not a nice place you have here.
Yeah, crunch. And Joe's just like, whoa, okay. So then he makes the offer to Joe, and there's this wonderful long pause, and Joe just goes, okay, I'll do it.
Like, it's right, kind of
shruggy, yeah, yeah.
And he does that a lot in the movie, where he's just like, okay.
Yeah. I could watch Lloyd Bridges in this part all day and all night. He is so alive in this movie. And I don't know who his idea was to kind of get these old-timey ringers for these parts. And there's one more. There's a couple more old-timers coming up. But, man, he is just so funny in this movie. It made me wish he had been in more movies when he was older, because he just crushes it in that one part.
It's almost – I mean, remember when he did Airplane? I mean, it's sort of like the craziness yes. – when he was in that film, because he's just nuts. He's almost like a Willy Wonka kind of guy.
Yeah,
you know,
at one point, yes.
He's talking, and he's like, do you have any whiskey? You know, and, then,
yeah.
Oh. And I love it later when Joe was like, kind of absorb what's going on. He goes, yeah, I lied. I've got whiskey. Hold on. Because yeah. Clearly he needs a drink now.
Yeah. Oh, man. Oh, he's got the naked lady pipe. I love that. He's got it's all wonderful. I really could have watched anybody who's listening to this, when you watch the movie again, and you should go watch it again. Watch Lloyd Bridges' body language when he does the final shtick about the he talks about it's the sweetest paradise you ever saw. He rocks back and forth like he's like it's 3D. He's just gonna burst through the screen. He is oh my god, he is so funny. He's so wonderfully funny in this movie.
And he's talking about things like the Waponi, which is just sounds funny anyway. And was it Big Woo, Great Woo? What's the name of the volcano?
Big Woo, I believe.
Big Woo. I mean, just things like that. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah. So Joe decides to go along with it, and the first stop on his trip is he goes to get some new clothes. And he hires a limo driver who's played by Ossie Davis. They have a wonderful scene together. Ossie Davis as Marshall. Again, another old-timer who just gets basically one sequence, and he kills it. He just kills it. Because he talks about, he asks Joe about what kind of clothes you want to get. And he's like, well, I don't know. And then he's like, why are you pulling the car over? And he's like, I believe clothes. And he's got that wonderful Ossie Davis voice, that deep voice. He's like, I believe clothes make the man, Mr. Banks. And he's like, you know, you have to find out who you are. I spent my whole life finding out who I am. I can't tell you who you are. You have to figure that out on your own. And that's when Joe does the shopping spree for his trip. And he ends up buying, of course, the luggage, which is...
Well, the music, too, though, throughout the whole shopping, you know, the montage of the shopping. You mentioned some of the music earlier. The music through this thing is phenomenal. And I can't remember what... I always think of Austin Powers. It must have played in Austin Powers as well, whatever. The music that's played during the shopping trip is, like, some of my favorite. I should have researched what it was. I apologize. But when you watch the movie, you'll know what I'm talking about. It's absolutely great. And as you said, Ozzy, he is just genius. He's so... Like, you want to hang out with him. You want him to be your mentor after you watch the scenes with him.
Yeah.
But you mentioned the luggage.
He also gets a haircut. Or she mentioned he gets a haircut, so he looks like Tom Hanks. And the hairdresser is played by Carol Kane.
Yes.
A little cameo by Carol Kane. And I would always allege that any movie with Carol Kane at least has something going for it, because it's Carol Kane.
Look like a prince in a fairy tale.
You're coming into focus, kid.
She's there.
And so then he goes to get this steamer trunks, and the steamer trunk salesman is a guy named Barry McGovern, who I'm not terribly familiar with. He's still working. He's still in movies. Mm-hmm. This is a guy who makes the most of his one scene, because as he puts it, luggage has been the preoccupation of his life to this point.
It's like, remember when you saw Beverly Hills Cop, right? And the guy who went on to do Imperfect Strangers, he stole that.
Pinchot, yeah.
Yes, he stole that entire scene. Mm-hmm. I mean, while this guy wasn't gregarious like that, this guy stole that scene. He was in command of this luggage scene.
Yeah.
A voyage?
A real ocean. Journey.
Oh, man.
And the thing I love about this whole sequence is it's like a video game. This is where Joe is amassing his weapons that he's going to need for the journey. It's like he gets a sword and a shield because he uses all the stuff that he gets.
Yes.
We see him buy an umbrella, which comes into play later on, and he's introduced to these steamer trunks, and they're in like a special room, and they have like their own lighting, and the guy's
angelic music plays when he's rolling them out.
Yeah, and the guy's going on and on about their hand stitched, and then of course they come with their own mini bar encased in them. And
so if I had the means, this would be my traveling luggage of choice.
Joe's response is, I'll take four, to which the luggage salesman says,
very anime, he leans immediately in to shake his hand and goes, "May you live to be 1,000 years, sir." And Joe does it so casually, too. It's like, okay, I'll take 4 of them.
Yeah,
you know, just plain as can be. Just like when he took the job from Admiral Kane. It was exactly the same.
And this is something that I think some of the best movies do this. And this was something I mentioned way back when me and the Sutherlands covered Gross Point Blank, is that every little character in this movie is a character, is given a bit. They're given something to do that's funny or memorable. I mean, the luggage salesman could just be in a flat character, but he's very memorable. Whole scene is really funny. So I love all that. So yeah, Joe buys the 4 steamer trunks, and he heads off to Los Angeles, where he meets up with the second Meg Ryan of the movie, which is Angelica, who, as she puts it, is a flibbertigibbet, which is where I learned that word. She is Granamore's daughter, and she is there to basically take Joe to the boat that's going to take him to the Polynesian island. And she is a classic L.A. creature, and she has that wonderful L.A. patois where she's, you know, Joe Banks. And she's like, you know, this town, it stinks, but I love it. What do you think? She has that very dramatic, and she's in this big red kind of fright wig. And they have a really wonderful scene together where we found out that she's a painter. She lives off her dad's money.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't have a real job. She just lives off her daddy's money. But there's this great scene of the two of them as they're parked on a cliff overlooking Los Angeles. And she talks about, out of nowhere, have you ever thought about killing yourself?
Right.
And Joe has a line of dialogue that I find very profound, where he says, basically, like, no, I've never thought about that. And he says, some things aren't even your business. I really found that very touching, that idea that, you know, you're not in control of your birth, and you shouldn't be in control of your death. Like, that's not your responsibility. You shouldn't even be worrying about that. That's going to come. That's not your job. Just that idea that that's not even something that you should be thinking that you're in control of is, I don't know. I found it really very beautiful.
It was very touching, the conversation. And then when he just says, you know, something along the lines of like, okay, well, I guess you should take me home, because they can't reach a common ground. One of the things I think that I saw going on there too, it's not right there on Front Street, so maybe I was seeing something I was thinking. As he's giving that, as you said, beautiful piece of dialogue about how you're not controlling your own destiny, what I saw behind Tom Hanks' eyes was, as he's delivering it, going, wait a minute, I am going to go kill myself.
Right, yeah.
So right. He's like saying that you shouldn't be in control of that, and he's like, wait a minute. And I think what he's thinking is, maybe I shouldn't be doing this. Maybe I shouldn't be jumping into the volcano. But it's really more of a powerful scene about her and how she hates herself because she lives off her daddy.
Yeah.
And it's really powerful. And she's not a likable character at all. In fact, I think when Meg Ryan was playing her, personally, I thought she was channeling maybe Melanie Griffith. I'm not sure. That's how I saw that. Not a fan. But this woman also, I mean, they don't make a big deal out of it. You see her popping pills at different times in the right. show. She's caked in makeup. Yeah, you described the voice perfectly. And so it was, yeah, there's a lot more going on with that character than I think the first time I saw it in 1990, I just hated that character. I was like, oh, she's obnoxious. But now as a mature adult, it's like, wow, there's a lot going on under the surface there.
Yeah, she talks about that her number one fear is giving up her dad's money and moving out of Los Angeles. And it's, you know, he's conquering his fear. He's going to go on this brave journey. And so he's trying to teach her, hey, you can go and, you know, go do this. And she offers to spend the night with him, which he turns down, which is kind of remarkable. And I should have mentioned earlier, he makes an offer to Marshall to go get a dinner with him. And Marshall says, I got the family. So Joe spends his last night in New York all by himself, which is really very interesting, I thought. He gets a drink by himself, and he goes to sleep, and he's by himself. And so he spends his last night before he goes on this boat all by himself. And then he meets up again with Angelica. She takes him to the boat, and that's where we meet Meg Ryan number 3, who is Patricia Granamore, the half-sister of Angelica. Yep. And Joe Banks says the great line, she's your half-sister? and immediately Patricia sets herself up to be a pain in the ass because she calls Joe Felix. And yeah. he's like, why do you keep calling me Felix? And she says, because I do what I want, which is like, all right, we get it. You're an independent person. Okay. And Joe's not having it. He's like, my name is Joseph and or Joe. And she sort of realizes she has to take him a little seriously.
But he's dressed ridiculous. I mean, he's got
yeah,
on like...
He's dressed like Ranger Rick, yeah.
Right. It's hilarious how ridiculous he looks. So I can see why she wouldn't take him seriously. She doesn't... And as we find out, she is also soul sick, like her sister,
right.
In her own way. Now, this is probably the most Meg Ryan of all the characters. This is the Meg Ryan you know from the movies.
Right, it's what she looked like in 1990.
Yeah. And boy, let me tell you, the scenes with Patricia made me remember why she was America's sweetheart. Like, I fell in love with her again. And I was just like, oh, I love this girl so much. And you talked about her career not being stellar. If I remember right, and I don't want to dwell on this much, but I seem to recall her career actually took a tank because of she had an affair with Russell Crowe, which...
That was definitely a black... The movie bombed as well. And so I think that was kind of... that was sort of the downward slide at that point, unfortunately.
Which is ridiculous because a man has an affair in Hollywood and everyone just moves on. And someone like her has one, and suddenly she's blacklisted? That's ridiculous.
It was weird, yeah. Her Hollywood, America's Sweetheart image got tarnished there. But yeah, but you said when she was good, she was great. Because she was in When Harry Met Sally, and this movie. She's wonderful in this movie. Mm-hmm. She and Hanks have a tremendous chemistry. She softens and realizes. She thinks that Joe is just like her dad's employee. And she really doesn't respect him. And she hates herself because in a great scene, she reveals that she... doesn't like her father, doesn't get along well with her father, and doesn't want anything to do with him. But then he said, he made her a deal, I'll give you this boat if you take Joe to the island. And she goes along with it. And she says in the speech to Hanks, you know, I have a price and my father named it. And now I know that about myself. And so you mentioned the line. She says she's soul sick. That comes up over and over again. I mean, in the opening scene, he stubs his shoe where he tears off part of his soul.
Yep.
On his shoe, and Dee Dee says, what's wrong, Joe? And he says, I'm losing my soul. So, I mean, this is a motif that goes out throughout the movie, is this talk of you losing your soul and being soul sick. But they have a wonderful, you know, kind of heart-to-heart. There's the great scene where he goes to bed for the night, and she just blurts out, did you sleep with my sister? Just out of nowhere. She's not her business, but she asks, and she's so sort of, I don't know, so direct about it. And he just is very sure. He's like, no. And she sort of likes Joe at that point because she realizes, oh, there may be a little more to this guy. And they have a nice heart-to-heart about that. And then they basically, you know, fall in love on this boat. It's really wonderful. They're terrific together.
There's an insane amount of on-screen chemistry between them, too. They just seem right together. And you can't help but like both of them. I mean, they both, at that point, were sort of almost, when I think of an everyman, I think of Jimmy Stewart, but they were sort of the everyman, every woman of the late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, Hanks is definitely in that Jimmy Stewart, was definitely in that Jimmy Stewart mold of the kind of American everyman, honest guy, and nice guy kind of thing. And yeah.
Getting into situations over his head.
And, yeah.
And damn it, I miss Tom Hanks doing comedy. He's genuinely a funny guy.
Yeah, he hasn't really... done one in a little while. He did that movie. Larry Crown,
which really?
Nobody
I don't even know what that was.
Well, exactly, which nobody saw. He directed it, and Julie Roberts is in it, but nobody really saw that one, so I don't know. Hmm. And he was in that Thing You Do, of course, but that was a while ago as well.
But he wasn't funny in that. I mean, there's some comedy in the film.
That's true.
But he plays that promoter who. The one who's sort of in on the joke. He knows these guys are one-hit wonders, you know?
Yeah, he's sort of mendacious in that movie, so I could see that. So, a storm hits the boat. The crew gets in trouble. One of the head member of the crew is Dagmar, played by Amanda Plummer, the great Amanda Plummer from Pulp Fiction. And so the lightning bolt hits the boat. It forms the shape. It forms that lightning bolt shape, and it wrecks the boat. Patricia gets knocked overboard. Joe saves her. The rest of the crew drowns, which is pretty dark for a little kind of lighthearted fantasy movie.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole crew drowns, and the only thing that saves them are what?
The glorious steamer trunks.
Joe stitches them all together. He puts Patricia on them. He protects her from the sun using the umbrella that he bought in New York, and he gives her the only water that he has available to him, which is in the bar, the little mini bar that came in one of the suitcases. And this, the moment here where he's waiting for Patricia to wake up and they're just floating aimlessly. I generally hate movies or hate scenes in movies where characters sing or like lip sync to songs that they grab hairbrushes and start singing, because it's just people don't do that.
Okay.
But Joe puts on the radio, and the only thing that he gets over the radio is the Del Vikings "Come Go With Me," which is a wonderful song. And he does a little dance to the Del Vikings song. And that scene makes me happy every time I watch it. It's only like 90 seconds. It gets over very quickly. But I just love watching Hank sing along to come and go with me. I think it's like movie magic.
Well, the whole drawn-out scene, I mean, it follows sort of its own little journey. It starts off with, you know, oh my gosh, we're barely alive, to, okay, we've made the best of it, we're going to have some fun now with the singing, to exhaustion, you know, starting to suffer the heat exposure, to almost I don't know what else to call it, but a spiritual moment in front of the moon.
Absolutely.
Which is... it's sort of hard to take it seriously because the special effects aren't there. I mean, clearly he's just floating in a pool, and they've added the moon in later. But
I like that it looks like
charming.
It was done on a set in 1945 with back projection. It has that kind of look to it.
Yeah. But just him there with his arms outstretched and everything, it's still powerful. It's another long shot. It's one of those long shots, too, where they just stay on him for a long time.
Yeah, it's a beautiful scene where he thanks God, which he says, whose name I do not know. Which is a nice way of making it for everybody. And he thanks God for his life. He thanks.
That's right.
And you know, he's ready to die there. Like he's thankful for his life. And you know, there's that quote. I wish I knew who said it, and I could look it up, I guess, but I'm not going to. But it's the whole thing about people that are satisfied with their lives aren't afraid of death, because they've lived their life. It's only people that are unsatisfied or afraid to die because they know that they're going to have regrets. And that's, Joe's happy in that moment. Yeah, he's gone on this adventure. He's conquered his fear. And even though the adventure isn't concluded yet, he's ready to go. And Hanks is terrific in it. I mean, he manages to sell this real moment in this very goofy movie. I mean, the moon is like the size of the Death Star. in the horizon. I mean, it's cartoon. It's beyond cartoony. It fills the screen, and it should be ridiculous, and yet it is not. It's a really terrific moment.
Mm-hmm.
So the next morning, Joe wakes up, and he's got sunburn, and Patricia has woken up, and she says, "Joe, didn't you give any water for yourself?" And he's, "No, no, no." And they end up making their way.
Of course, she's gloriously gorgeous. You know,
yeah,
that moment.
She looks wonderful. Yeah, she
stunning. Looks great. You know, stunning, and he's like on death's door.
Yeah, he's got all those like sores on his face and stuff. So anyway, they end up wandering over to the island, which is where they were headed for, and they're met by the welcoming committee, which is Nathan Lane.
Crazy
Nathan Lane playing one of these Polynesian Jewish. I forget the racial background, but it's like...
Oh, that's right. There's a weird story.
Polynesian, Jewish, and Greek or something. Some weird combo. They like orange soda.
They love orange soda.
They have no sense of direction. That's
the Waponies.
Waponies, yeah.
And you would never know it's Nathan Lane except his voice.
Right. He's, "Are you Joe Banks?" Like, yes. Oh, and they're all happy. So they're happy that Joe has arrived to sacrifice himself. And they put Joe up along with Patricia, and they go through all the rigmarole. And it's funny. I love the differing scenes where Joe's preparation to jump in the volcano is like being slapped with fish.
Right.
Meanwhile, Patricia is being like getting a manicure and a pedicure. Like she's being treated like the Aga Khan. Meanwhile, Joe is getting slapped around, and he finally is like, "Enough! All right, enough, enough, enough."
Well, those are good examples of like the kookiness of this movie, where things just get like insanely ridiculous. That scene, there's the earlier scene we didn't mention where they're fishing and he pulls up a hammerhead shark and
the shark's
in his face.
Oh, you're right.
Where he's going
I wanted to mention that. I even wrote that in the note. Yes, they do the fishing scene where he pulls up a hammerhead shark. I love that puppet.
It's a ridiculously rubbery puppet, and it's just funny.
Oh my God.
It's just an example of how ridiculous, and we're going to get to something in a bit. We're working towards something here about the ridiculousness of the film, but it's ridiculously but funny, and both those scenes are good examples of going way over the top.
Oh, I love that puppet. Oh, just, and the way and Hanks's reaction, because when he first pulls it up, he's not looking, and then he turns around and he sees it. The thing looks like a dinosaur, and he just starts screaming uncontrollably. Oh man, it's set to the tune of "Good Lovin'." That's the song during that whole montage. Oh, I forgot. I'm glad you mentioned that. I forgot. That's such a great. I love that scene.
I think I'm gonna go through the end credits again and find every one of the songs that are in here and just build a Joe versus the Joe V Volcano soundtrack.
You can buy the soundtrack. It exists.
But is it score or is it?
Oh,
all these,
you know what?
I think it's
maybe the score. It's not.
Yeah,
the,
like I want all these songs because they're just great.
Yeah, that's a great collection. So anyway, they get to the island. They're gonna Joe's gonna sacrifice. So he meets the chief, played by Abe Vigoda.
of course it is.
Of course, by Abe Vigoda. And he's like, "Hey, is there any ceremony? No, you just jump in." So okay, and at that moment, Joe and Patricia decide to get married. Because, you know, they admit that they love each other and she doesn't want him to go, you know, and she doesn't want him to go. And he's like, I have to do this. And he's like, you know, she's like, I love you. I love you too. But the timing stinks. I got to go.
And it just turns and goes.
Yeah. He's got to jump into the volcano because otherwise the island's going to sink. Right. And she decides to go with him. She decides to, they're going to hold hands and jump into the volcano. And they're kind of like, well, we'll just see what happens. And this is how fully bought into this ridiculousness of this movie that the idea of jumping into a volcano is a moment for saying, well, let's see what happens.
Right.
You're going to know what's going to happen. You're going to melt to death in lava. That's what's going to happen. There is no uncertainty about what's about to happen to you. So,
but it's touching, and you buy it, beautiful. And you feel like her, because it's her pushing the scene. He's more like, I don't care. You know, he's ready to jump. He doesn't want to even get married. When she says, let's get married, he's like, I don't want to do that. And basically, he does it to shut her up. But you know he still loves her, though. Yeah. He just doesn't want to be bothered with the ceremony because he wants to go jump in the volcano. And she's the one driving this whole scene there. And it's just – again, it makes her so endearing and so charming because she's just bullying her way into his love life, you know. And it's wonderful.
Yeah, it's great. So they jump into the volcano, and at that exact moment, some sort of air pocket shoots up and spits them right back out. And they fly through the air, which again should sink the movie.
Yes.
And yet it does not.
It
sinks the island. You're completely bought into the craziness of this universe that it seems like an utterly plausible turn of events that they get spit out. And the whole island sinks, the volcano ruptures, the whole island sinks, and Joe and Patricia are left floating in the water. And then of course 2 seconds later, up come the suitcases. So,
well, they say, how are we going to survive? And then the trunks don't just surface. They explode out of the water. Like, clearly some crewman was holding them down and released them because they come bursting up. Yep. And they say something along the lines of, like, wherever we go, whatever we do, we're taking this luggage with us.
Yes. It's fantastic. So they get on the suitcases, and they're like, well, what are we going to do now? Well, he's like, I'm still dying. And he makes an offhanded comment about his doctor, and he mentions Dr. Ellison, and that's where Patricia reveals that Dr. Ellison is her father's doctor. He doesn't have any patients other than his father. The whole thing was a setup from the beginning to get the boobaro, the precious boobaro, which I never tried saying that word, boobaro.
Clearly.
So much fun. So, and then, which means, of course, Joe doesn't actually have a brain cloud, and she chastises him for not getting a second opinion. You got something called a brain cloud, and you think they get a second opinion?
Well, I love whenever Hanks refers to it. He just kind of waves his head over this, like as if he has a seam along the middle of between the left and right hemispheres of the brain. He just kind of waves his hand over there as if, you know, that says it all. It's like, well, it's a brain cloud.
I knew it. I didn't know it, but I knew it. And so of course, he's relieved, but then he starts coughing again.
Mm-hmm. He's sick again all of a sudden,
and it's up to Patricia to point out to him that he is in fact a hypochondriac, and he's going to live, and they have the rest of their lives together to look forward to. And when last we see them, they are on the suitcases floating away, and as Joe says, we're headed away from the things of man. And
yes.
The movie ends with a wonderful painting of a rowboat on the water at night. It's a really beautiful, and the credits roll, and you know you. I just love this movie to death, and it's, you know, it's this thing peers into my soul, this movie, every time I watch it.
Well, it's uplifting, first of all, and especially for someone who's had one of those soul-sucking jobs where or if you feel trapped at some point in your life and you think things can't get any better. And you see Joe. Well, you know, let's get into the themes of the movie, because maybe this will kind of explain why it's so uplifting. First off, the movie's not subtle. at all. I mean, all the themes we're going to talk about, they are not even remotely subtle about any of this. They put it right out there. There's no nuance here. Subtext, it's text. First one, and some of this, I've done a little research and reading other people's thoughts on the film. And I had had most of these. I'll credit the ones that I didn't come up with on my own. But first, don't sell yourself. Sell your soul to the company. You know, don't get yourself trapped in a situation where you're just giving everything and it's not giving you anything back. That's one of the themes of this movie. And I think, as we said earlier, you and I have both found ourselves in that situation before.
Oh, yeah.
Next one's live your life to the fullest. Don't wait. Don't sit around and think, I'll get to that someday. And you talked about that earlier, you know, as far as the people that wait to do stuff and people that go and do it. And that's what that movie's telling you, is go do it. This is one I stole from the internet, which I thought was funny. Clothes and luggage make the man.
Yes.
I don't know if that's really a life lesson from the film, but I had to mention it because the luggage isn't there.
I think it definitely is pro treating yourself.
Yes, you know? I would agree with that.
It's not necessarily in a material way, but just like, there's nothing wrong with treating yourself, you know? Yeah. Because you get the sense that Joe and the way he dresses in the beginning in all gray and everything doesn't really fit. It's all too big. His hair is, you know, kind of matted and rangy. It doesn't look very good. He's given up. He's just given up. And it's when he gets the haircut and he looks sharp and everything else, he's starting to care about himself. In fact, Marshall has the line about he says when he gets the haircut, he goes, "You're coming into focus, kid."
That's true. He does. Yeah. Good point. Huh. All right. Two more themes. One is, and this one's a maybe. This one I also saw on the internet, but it kind of also makes sense. One of the major themes, at least with Angelica and Patricia, was don't rely on your parents too much. Grow up. Stop. You know, don't be a leech on somebody else. Stand on your own two feet. You know, that's a bit. But the other one that I think is also very uplifting, it's about love. Now, twice in the film, once he says to Dee Dee, "I feel like I'd seen you before."
Yes.
When I first saw you. And then when he sees Patricia, "I feel like I'd seen you before." And Meg Ryan's playing three characters. I think there's more to it. It's not just a fun thing to have her play three characters. I think they're trying to tell us something that sort of like – and all three of these women he cared for in some way or another.
Yes.
It's almost like they're trying to tell you that every woman that you care about or that you're interested in has a piece of them that's part of a puzzle. And when you get that puzzle finally put all together – you're going to find the one woman you truly love. And that's who Patricia is. But Dee Dee was a piece of that puzzle. Angelica was a piece of that puzzle. And Patricia is the finished puzzle. That's kind of how I read that. And between the love and not letting your soul get sucked out, that's what makes me feel so good about this movie.
Yeah, I agree. You're right. Dee Dee is not – she's not ready to go with him with the new Joe. She's not ready yet. And Patricia's not exactly right. I love
– And Angelica's not right.
Angelica. They give Angelica a line, which I still use to this day, where he mentions – I forget what he mentions, what he does for a living or something, what he did. He says something boring, and she just waits and goes, "I have no response to that."
I have no response to that. I can't do that voice.
I love when she says that. And I have used that unironically since. When people have told me things and I literally have nothing to say to it, I just go, "I have no response to that." Because it's just like I'm acknowledging you're saying something, but I literally have no reaction to what you just told me. So I love that she says that. And I love her delivery. I just, she's terrifically funny in that part.
Quotes in this movie. I mean, you know, "May you live to be a thousand." I've used many times, "May you live to be a thousand years, sir." I've used that many times. I've used when I'm like, I don't want to say at a party, but when I'm like I did it when we started this call. When I'm ready to go somewhere, I have been known to yell, "Take me to the volcano." You know, I mean, there's some great lines. In fact, you posted something about Joe versus the volcano on Facebook today.
And brain it's cloud. Like, yeah, I mentioned the brain cloud.
And the message thread is just a bunch of quotes.
Yep.
People throwing quotes. It's people love this film.
Yeah. Yeah. I was doing some research on it and I found an article, and I'll post it in the show notes, an essay that this, a woman named Leah, forget her last name, but she wrote a long essay about how much she loves this movie. I mean, seriously, this thing goes on and on and on, and I read every word of it. And at the bottom, she goes, "Wow, I guess I had a lot to say about Joe versus the volcano." and then I look and there's 27 comments.
Oh,
and
wow.
Every comment is, "I thought I was the only person that loves this movie."
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like it was this whole clique that nobody knows about because this movie came out pre-internet.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. And like by the time the internet came around, I don't think the cult had developed yet. But it's now probably developed in the last 10 years. And so no one knows. But yeah, people, you know, I mean, people have found this movie and love it. But you don't know it because it's not necessarily a movie you talk about. It's not a particularly famous movie, especially since Hanks and Ryan went on to do Sleepless in Seattle, which was like probably definitely the most famous of their collaborations.
Oh yeah, without a doubt. Yeah. Now, we got to talk about this symbol, this weird lightning bolt-shaped symbol. Now, it appears several times in the movie. You named almost all of them. There was two you didn't name. So we named the company logo. We named the walkway going up into the company is also the shape. We mentioned the lightning bolt that struck the boat, sank that. And then the two other ones is the path going up the volcano. They're lit by the torches as they're going up there. Right. And then this time when I watched it, I noticed one more I had never noticed before, which is – remember the giant crack on Joe's wall in his apartment?
Is it there too?
It's in – the crack itself is in that shape.
Oh, that's great.
And I wonder if there's more in there I didn't catch. But, I mean, he wasn't – they weren't very – other than that one with the crack, they weren't very subtle about it. So, again, subtlety, not part of this film. But what is the symbol – mean? You know, I've been racking my brain. And, you know, in some ways, did it represent the corporation holding Joe down? Because then it's there in his apartment as well. And when it destroys the boat, is it destroying something good? Or is that lightning bolt actually, is the symbol freeing Patricia from her obligation to her dad? You know, is the path going up the volcano a good thing? A bad thing? I don't know. Was it just a cool visual cue? What do you think?
Part of it, I think it is a visual, but I don't know. I would tend to think that it's the crooked path of life. Your life doesn't go in a straight line, and that's what it's represented. Now, sometimes it can be a bad path, and sometimes it's a good path, but it's crooked. I mean, the gist of it, where they make the path that's the path the employees have to take, is ridiculous, because why would you make them walk in that zigzag pattern when you could just make a straight line? But I have to say, it recalled to me back when I worked at a book distributorship in the late 90s, and everyone in the office, the company had several hundred employees, and everyone had to punch out. You had a time card. And in a building with several hundred employees, they only had two time clocks entire building. So if you wanted to get out at 5 o'clock, you had to like surround the time clock and get your card and do it. And there was like, you know, 50 other people trying to do it too. And I remember thinking, there is no earthly reason that there's only two time clocks in this giant building. And that made me think that is simply forgive my language, that's a mind fuck. That is how employers keep employees down. It's a reminder of you're a cog, and we're not even going to give you the respect of not making you stand around to punch out. Because there's no reason to only have 2 clocks. When you have that many employees, you need more than 2 clocks. And I look at the path that they make the employees walk to get to this factory job is the same thing. We're making you waste steps to get here, and that reminds you that you're not in control of your own destiny. It's a way of beating someone down even before they've walked in the door.
It's also a disgusting example of corporate synergy with the logo, but
right.
I think you're onto something with the crooked path of life. I really do. I think that's got to be that makes the most sense of anything I've heard.
I mean, because Joe goes from New York to Los Angeles and then to this island. Like, you know, he's being bopped around by all these different people. It's not what you would expect necessarily. So,
And it's not the path he expected to follow in life. And then once Admiral Kane, and I keep saying that, it's a Battlestar Galactica reference. Someone will get it. Once Admiral Kane puts him on this path, he doesn't even follow that path because, you know, the boat sinks and all this other stuff. So yeah. That's really cool. Now, there's one more huge thing we got to talk about. So, been dancing around it, been talking about how bonkers this movie is. I had seen this in writing in many places. A lot of people refer to the movie as almost like a cartoon because the characters are so gregarious. They're so outrageous. You know. Again, Admiral Kane, Lloyd Bridges is hysterical. You know, in his role, Robert Stack. You know, the scene with the fish, where the shark comes up, and the scene where he's being hit with a fish. They're all funny. They're comical. They're ridiculous. They get blown out of the volcano. It's like a cartoon. And then, Rob, what did you stumble across today?
IMDb says, now who knows? You know, caveat emptor when it comes to IMDb trivia, because they let any insane person, I think, just comment in there. But supposedly, this film is inspired by a Walt Disney short starring Goofy called Hello Aloha. And the plot of Hello Aloha is in Goofy has a job, and he ends up going on a vacation, and he ends up becoming someone who's going to sacrifice himself for a volcano on this island. It's mm-hmm. the exact plot of Joe versus the volcano.
It's more than what you're just saying, too, because in the start, the job Goofy has is horrible. His boss right. is horrible. Right. His boss is yelling at him. And, well, he doesn't have a lamp he stares at. He has a calendar.
The calendar, right.
And when you Rob shared this with me, I was like, what? Nah. And I watched it. I'm like, holy crap. You know, this really does seem like – I mean, it's almost beat for – well, not beat for beat, but there's a lot of similarities. Yeah. Well, I've scoured the internet everywhere I can. I can find – other than that IMDb trivia fact that's not even backed up with a citation, I cannot find any connection, any reference anywhere of Aloha Hello and Joe versus the Volcano connected. No interviews with the director, the writer, nothing that connects the two. Yeah. So whether it – now, one of the things I – so – but watching it, I'm like, of course it has to be. But then I stumbled across some other stuff about the one of these, you know, TV tropes websites where it talks about the trope of appeasing the volcano gods. And there are so many pop culture films and movies and comic strips and articles and stuff going back to the 1926 was the earliest one I saw talking about appeasing the volcano god. And so it may just be a big fat coincidence because there's so that trope is so out there, but I don't know. You guys, you've got to go watch it. It's on YouTube. Aloha Hello. It's only 6 minutes long. It's adorable. And it's like watching a 6 minute version of Joe versus the Volcano without the romance.
Yeah. Yeah. And John Patrick Shanley was born in 1950. And I think that short is from 57. So, I mean, you know, Shanley would have been pretty much the right age to have seen it. You know, it's not like he would have been too old or too young. So I think it's, I wouldn't say for a moment that it's ripped off. It's inspired by it. It's the same way yes. that Scrooge yes. McDuck inspired Raiders of the Lost Ark. I mean, Scrooge McDuck comics have comics with scenes with giant boulders that chase the kids and mysterious glowing idols that have death traps attached to them. So, you know, I put this in the same vein as that. So, yeah, it's a wonderful little detail. John Patrick Shanley is on Twitter. And I maybe should, when this episode drops, maybe I should tweet at him and mention that we did it and also ask him, hey, man, what about the Goofy cartoon? Is that a real
yeah.
thing?
Yeah, you know. You should. And it's also kind of fitting, again, because Joe versus the Volcano is so cartoonish.
Yes.
You know? It's a nice, you know, symmetry there.
The colors fun are vivid. Film. Yeah, the colors are very much like a cartoon. It's very vivid. It's got a very distinct look to it. I said it's got a fairy tale. I mean, it opens with Once Upon a Time. It has a very yep. fairy tale look and feel to it. As I mentioned, I love the kind of fakery of the water. I mean, some of the scenes are clearly on location. The fishing stuff is all done for real. You can see they're on a real boat and they're really out there. But the scenes with Patricia on the raft are clearly done in a tank, in a studio, and I love it. I love the matte paintings in the background. It just gives it that wonderful artificiality that I love old-timey movies to have, and I love it when current movies try and replicate that, sort of like yeah. the Bruce Willis scene in the cab in Pulp Fiction with a black and white background and a color movie. you know, I mean, I love all that kind of stuff. And so this thing, to me, is really meticulously put together from beginning to end, and it seems silly, it seems frivolous. The movie was not well-received at the time. Some critic compared it to Howard the Duck.
What?
Yeah, and said it was like never seen a more lead-footed comedy, and I just don't buy that at all. Luckily, Roger Ebert loved it and was an early champion of the movie. I think he gave it like 3.5 out of 4 stars, and he just thought it was delightful. And like I said, I have never not loved this movie. And, you know, I just think it's so touching and beautiful. It's a great love story, but the journey that Joe goes on is wonderful. And, you know, yeah, am I ready to go the way Joe is? No. I would have lots of regrets. I still think I'm in the kind of Mr. Waturi phase of my life, unfortunately. And, you know, not quite that bad, but you know, I don't necessarily want to go live on a Polynesian island, but it's just the idea of trading your life for a couple of bucks a week. That's a very powerful message. And, yep. you know, it's easy for movies to say, oh, drop everything and go have a vacation because, well, yeah, I need health insurance too. But I mean, there is something for saying, like, it kind of reminds me a little bit of the movie I talked about with Max Romero, Defending Your Life, the Albert Brooks mm-hmm. movie, where, you know, that character dies and they judge him for how much he lived according to fear. And Joe has given up his fear. Joe knows he's going to die, and that has freed him from worrying about it because he knows it's going to happen. And it's like a perverse, you know, reverse way of looking at things. You would think that once you know you're going to die, that's all you could focus on. But in fact, it frees Joe up from having to worry about anything. So he can just go and live his life and bond with people. He bonds with Marshall. He bonds with Patricia. He bonds with all these people that he meets instantaneously. And it doesn't take very long until he's gotten close to them all.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting you mentioned defending your life because in those comment threads on a lot of sites I was looking at where people were doing sort of the same thing going, oh, my gosh, I thought I was the only one who loved this movie. A lot of times the conversation then revolves back to defending your life. A lot of people love both of these films and for those same messages you just brought up. So I'm thankful to say I'm out of the Mr. Waturi part of my life. I feel like I've got a great job. I married the woman of my dreams. I've got kids. I love what we're doing with the podcast. I'm thrilled with life right now. So I feel like just saying, take me to the volcano.
Fair enough. Like I said, I'm still working on it. I'm still working on it, but that's okay. And this movie made me feel good today, and it was great to watch it again. And it's just, I mean, we gave away the entire plot beat for beat, but it doesn't matter. You should see it anyway. It's all about the process. This is just a really wonderful little gem. And I honestly think if I ever got a chance to meet Tom Hanks, I never will, but if I ever did, this would be the movie I would bring up. I think this would be the one, not even the ones he's won Oscars for or his important works. I think I'd be like, dude, man, Joe versus the Volcano. That's the, you know, that's the movie. I just think it's such a wonderful, delicate little snow globe of a movie, and it's precious and everything else. And, you know, it hits me in all the right places, and I love it. I love talking about it. I love watching it, and you know, I want to watch it again now. I've already talked about it. I want to see it again.
I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about it because I've sort of lived in solitary as a fan of this for 27 years now, and it's nice to be able to spend an hour of my life celebrating it. So thank you.
And what are the odds? It's so funny. When I mentioned it on Facebook, I had no idea anybody liked it, and then you told me what you loved. I was like, really? That's amazing, because we had never brought it up.
I actually threatened you. I said, if you have anyone else on the show, yeah, I'd probably kill you or something.
That's a very nice gesture. As we've seen in previous episodes, I respond well to terroristic threats, unfortunately.
True, absolutely.
Yeah, go see Joe vs. Volcano, buddy. It's available on iTunes. It's on DVD. You can get it anywhere. It's really, really great. So.
And may all of you live to be 1,000 years.
There's that luggage. Well, Shag, thank you for coming on back to Film and Water. It's been a while.
Only my second appearance.
Only your second appearance. Well, is it only your second? Yeah, I guess it is only your second appearance. Okay. Well, thank you for coming back and talking about Joe vs. Volcano, man.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me.
Do we want to plug our stuff or do we want to sign off? Because I think everybody knows, right? Or do you want to plug some shows?
I don't need – I should probably say my name. I'm the Irredeemable Shag, folks, by the way. Nice to meet you.
Okay. FireAndWaterPodcastNetwork.com. Take out network. That's not part of the thing. FireAndWaterPodcast.com. You can find all our shows there. That's good. All right. Well, thanks, everybody, for listening. And until next week, that's a wrap. Beyond the sea, I know.